I'm Tao Hong. I am a former diplomat and currently an advocate for financial inclusion.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
It's funny that it's a subtle thing, but you don't like talking about yourself. And, you know, through the many times that we've talked to each other, I know you don't like it. So, but that's why I really thank you for coming on today.
I'm happy to. I think we were talking about boundaries before coming on the call. One has to know what our boundaries are, but I think, you know, for growth, you kind of have to push it sometimes. And yes, You've been so kind enough to create the space for our community and spare the time for me. So I'm going to rise to the occasion and get past my discomfort of talking about myself. But I also recognize this is an opportunity to get to know you. So I am very excited about our conversation today.
Oh, thank you. And I'm, you know, open. I'm game to be asked questions and to answer questions. So whenever you feel like it, if it's ever, you know, appropriate or relevant to our conversation, feel free to do so.
Great. That sounds fun. Thanks.
So something that you said that was quoted is, I think, I don't know if it was during your time as a foreign service officer or after, but you said something to the fact diplomacy is not diplomacy. I think you're talking about your years working as a diplomat. What did you mean by that?
I think it's an interesting journey that might be helpful to give context to. But my idea, you know, I come from a family of refugees that have escaped, a fallen system in government. And always as a child, I thought to myself, like, what can I do to be a part of peace and to support dialogue, to avoid a situation like this? And so I was that kid, if you ever asked me at the time, what do you want to be when you grow up? I always thought the answer and the right answer is to be a diplomat. And, you know, following that path, it took me to the State Department as a foreign service officer. And diplomacy at the time for me meant like with the official passport, representing a government with the talking points and being an official envoy of a government to be able to facilitate peace. But to the point that you raised, it is my learnings after many years. I think it's been 20 years since I left since I joined the State Department. But as you know, I since left. I've learned a few things that you don't need a black passport, a diplomat passport, and have a business card that says that you're a representative of X country. Everybody in their own roles, in their own way, could be a diplomat. In fact, you are a diplomat of the Vietnamese diaspora, speaking and sharing stories about us and sharing the humanity that we have and sharing that humanity with each other to encourage that peace. And so that soundbite is really, you know, formal diplomat, big D, is not necessarily a role just for folks who are in the government spaces. But I think in a past role in aircraft sales or in a past role doing trade negotiations, in a past role current role in advocacy, the storytellers that we have on this podcast, they're all diplomats in their own way. And so I feel like we shouldn't limit ourselves by, you know, titles, because there's an opportunity to build peace in other ways through, you know, government relations and, you know, social interaction, trade, business, etc. So that's really what I meant in the sentiments there, that, you know, to be a diplomat is not necessarily diplomacy. You can be doing those things in other roles.
Not everybody who applies to the State Department to become a diplomat actually gets in. And once you're in and you do all those years, what made you get out?
This is recorded, right? No, I'm kidding. No, what made, thanks, Ken, a lot for like an easy softball question. I appreciate it. No, I, at the time, you know, I joined in 2004. It's a different US. It was a different conversation that we were having in the international space. And so I felt like, well, let's give it a go and be the diplomat. I checked the box. But being in the role, again, it was just a learning that I saw business folks in Shanghai, in Vietnam, in Taipei that were having deeper conversations about jobs and trade and facilitating, relationships that had no borders. And I just realized, oh my goodness, my role in the State Farm is kind of limited to that. Like I am the envoy with talking points from the US government to share with a counterpart in China or Taiwan or wherever I was at the time. And so it occurred to me that, if I were very interested and if my values wanted to be expanded, I could do so elsewhere, not just at the State Department. And I feel very blessed that that experience was there. So I know the role for government to government relations and government to business and the role that that plays. But it occurred to me that I think I could do more working in other spaces of commerce in the private sector or now in philanthropy that I'm in an advocacy role.
And what country, what were you assigned to a specific country?
Yeah, I was assigned in mostly in East Asia, but I spent time in Taipei, in Shanghai, and a chunk of my career was in Washington, D.C. at the mothership. And my last rotation was with the U.S. Trade Office. We were working on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which now is no longer, but I see different pockets of that agreement and the opening of dialogue of trade. Happening in many other instances, not as the big trade agreement. But I think I find it fascinating because even in those roles, you can find space outside of your official role to be creative. And especially in the trade space, we in the US have like a pretty big market, right? And the doors of that market is very valuable for many markets to come and sell goods. And so to ensure that the trade is fair and that, there's fair labor, the products are made well, and it makes sense. Yes, that's when we use our doors to open, but also to encourage good behavior. And so it really opened my eyes to what opportunities can a tool like trade be facilitating diplomacy. I think at the time we were working with Egypt and Israel actually on a free trade agreement where they have to work together to combine their inputs in order to facilitate the free trade to the US. So there's just, again, like folks may not be aware that these are the workings of a lot of very patriotic government officials that are also thinking about what can we do to make sure it's a safer space out there and that we're facilitating that peace. So I'm quite proud of the colleagues that I work with and the kind of policies that we are supporting. But I'm also very proud of the policies that we're dissenting on and the dialogue there. And I think, we're having a government conversation. There is space for individuals not just be machines and an extension of the government, but also debate, right? This is the space of the US government where we can talk about things that we disagree with and not be put in jail for it. And so I think there is really a lot of pride in that the history I have being a diplomat representing that, those values, and also recognize we're not always perfect. And so this is where I think the dialogues that we have on this podcast, the stories that Enviek is telling with the sympathizer and Christina is talking about, each of us has an element of what is America, and we're having that dialogue and the, and the discourse. And I think that's really something to celebrate. So I'm glad I could be a little part of it in some way.
Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me And together, we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
I just want the audience to know how much you were kicking and screaming about coming on the podcast and not wanting to come on and saying you didn't have a whole lot to say, but we are just scratching the surface right now of what, of how much you have to offer on what's going on in your mind. As I understand it, you at the time weren't, it's allowed is not the right word, right? Vietnamese were not allowed to be in the State Department in Vietnam. I mean, what was going on there?
Right. I think this is, again, it's another time 20 years ago where I think the policies weren't as self-aware, I think is the best way to say it, as it could be. And so somebody who is a Vietnamese American diplomat, I think they worried about our security in Vietnam. And likewise, Chinese Americans, likewise, Russian Americans, if we are diplomats, the security colleagues would hesitate to send us. And in fact, I think it took many years and dissent from a lot of colleagues that have different backgrounds from their country's diaspora to be able to break through. So during my time, there was actually a consul general in Ho Chi Minh City, in our parents' parlance, Saigon, who was Vietnamese American and stationed there and pretty high up during the 2026 APEC conference even. So, I mean, this is kind of new stuff. And at the time when I was stationed in Taipei, it was this really funny gray area where they said, no, I don't think you should be stationed in Vietnam, even though the need was there and I speak Vietnamese and it'd be fine. And so it did cause me, to scratch my head. I'm like, I wonder what other biases are reflected in our policies, right? And that's where you do need to figure out like the advocacy to change some of the things that you think aren't right. And so I think this is the experience of a lot of the Foreign Service officers that are, again, representing the U.S. They're not all Yale and Pale. We have very diverse backgrounds. There is a space for us to be able to be stationed anywhere of our choosing and fit. And the things that are maybe not data backed should not be informing these decisions. Yeah. So
I mean, that wasn't very long ago, 20 years ago.
It wasn't very long ago, but I think things have changed. I mean, the State Department's always an evolving entity, thank goodness. There's a long way to go, but I've since seen improvements. I'm not saying there couldn't be a lot more and it couldn't be more accelerated, but as in any large institution, it is pretty tricky for them to figure out. And I think also I'll show up with kindness there. I think they were worried for my safety, right? They were worried for me being an asset or turned into an asset and all this other stuff that, you know, the intrigue of diplomacy, you can walk that thread any way you want to. But, the requirements to be in the State Department and a Foreign Service officer is that you have to be over 21 when you start serving, and you have to be a U.S. citizen and you pass the exams and there's a role for you. But it doesn't say your vulnerabilities to being an asset and preclude you. So it's things that are changing. And then, I'm glad that some of these things are brought to light that, hey, there might be some bias here. There might not be data-backed decision-making. So let's encourage data-backed decision-making there.
Yeah, there's actually a Christina Lay, who's been on my podcast, and she's talked about her experience at the State Department. I think she's been there 14 years. And then right before she came on, was leaving the Vietnam. She came on the podcast and talked about sort of her hopes and dreams. And, you know, we're going to hopefully have her back after another year or two if she leaves the post, because she wants to kind of like finish up and we can talk about it after she gets back.
Yeah, you might get the full deal after she leaves. Because I listened to that interview and she was amazing. I see that as something that you are gifting to the world, like the stories of these individuals that are doing amazing things and her background coming into the role. I'm really proud of seeing a legacy of amazing individuals in the State Department, and continues to be. My former colleagues are still there And to see folks like Christina moving up the ranks and being a section chief in Vietnam, I'm so proud. That was not the case when I was there. And it just again points to the fact that things change for the better if you, you know, again, push and advocate for good decision making and good policies.
You have been out of the State Department for, you know, you've left 2 decades now. How closely tuned in do you stay with the world of the State Department? And, you know, whether it be through the reading or calling former colleagues up, how connected do you stay to that world now?
I stay connected, but it's quite interesting. My career took on very different turns. The State Department, as you probably know, is very much a let's talk about the present political economic issues that relates to the U.S. government and U.S. policy. My world right now is in development. And so there is overlap because it can't be done separately. So I still stay in touch with colleagues in Washington, D.C. But I also spend a lot more time looking at different issues in different markets in like the lower middle income countries. So I'm advocating for financial inclusion in those spaces of, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, and figuring out, well, how do we get money into the hands of women? We all know that that's a good idea. So it's easy to call back my friends in the State Department and be like, hey, do you think it's a good idea for women's financial inclusion? Of course they agree. But it's not, again, talking about like the issue with, you know, trade negotiations and hard economic issues that you would traditionally think is diplomacy. This falls into more of the aid space, but yeah. Of course there's overlap.
Before we go into your work in philanthropy, I wanted to see if there was like a sort of a bridge question that you could answer for me. It's very broad, but I sit with people who are artists who make no money at all, who are broke. And I sit with people who make lots and lots of money in closed private rooms and we hang out and have cigars. So there's like that.
Who are you hanging out with in those rooms? And what are you drinking? You do know, I should have added to my intro that I'm also a huge food person. And so we could have that conversation too.
We typically drink whiskey.
That's nice.
Probably what the drink of choice is. And so I often ask this question, and I think it falls squarely in your realm, perhaps. The disparity that we have in the world first, right? The U.S. and developing countries, the rich and poor, the disparity between those things are sort of, you could see it, you could feel it on the ground when you're there. But this disparity that's happening in the United States is becoming more and more, that the space between us all is getting further and further apart. I really wonder sometimes if we are able to do this closing of that gap in the United States, and then obviously the next is, are we going to be able to do it around the world? This closing of the monetary gap between rich and poor is getting bigger and bigger. It's not getting smaller and smaller. So can you give me your thoughts on that before we move on to philanthropy?
These are things that we think about all day, all the time. And you made me think about, I have amazing colleagues in the organization I work with. And this morning, actually on a call, a colleague said something that is still resonating with me. And I feel like it's going to stick with me as a value as well, is that like, how do I be a good ancestor? And isn't that, I mean, I'm just going to mic drop that. How do I be a good ancestor? And this is coming from a woman who has, ancestor. I know, right? And this is coming from a woman who has similar background as us, right? Somebody who came from basically nothing in a space and it was education that was a foundational stepping stone out of poverty or access that her parents' parents wouldn't have not had access to. And I think to myself, like, what is the system that has caused the situation to be it is and continues to perpetuate it? And I know one of those pieces being curious more recently to history, the origins of colonialism, inequity, slavery, these institutions that still remain with us today in different form. And so I'm curious the fact that, what are those things that can get us beyond that? And a lot of the times the answer feels easy, right? Why don't you just cut checks to poor people? And why don't you build up the education system? There are so many components. You cannot tell me that there's like one silver bullet for all of it. But what we do know, and I love that we're doing this, and this is part of the dialogue that we're having, not just here, but elsewhere, is like, is the capitalist system the right one anymore? And is it maybe not having the right principles or traps that hold people who are extractive accountable? And does it make sense even for the rich to be this rich, right? Like, I don't want to sound like I'm foaming at the mouth socialist. Don't get me wrong. Like, I shouldn't even like convey it as that, because I almost think that, these folks who are often labeled as certain things, they're just curious, like, could things be better? Could we have more humane policies? Could we have a more progressive tax structure? And who's against that? And you kind of wonder why, right? And so I think there's a lot of work to be done. And Kenneth, I'm pretty sure you have opinions about this too, because you're in the spaces
I'm dying
talking to
to give
these
you.
folks deeply. Like, what is your view there?
Give you my view. Just ask me.
No, I would love to hear your view. Like, I'm thinking colonialism, I think institutions, where can I make investments to inoculate some of these things and lift up folks out of poverty? But I would love your view, because you're at the individual level and there's wisdom in the stories that you've been exposed to. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that
Well, I'm
too.
gonna answer with posing a question first, and then we can go from there, I think. So at this dinner, one particular dinner, last few days ago, I posed the question with these cognac drinking men. I said the disparity is getting further and further, and it's on my mind constantly. And I think it is not what we think it is. And this is going to be super controversial, but
Oh, throw it out there.
what if smart people come with not just the toolkits from social conditioning and nurture alone, but what if it's really nature that they're given sort of like they've been given talents with their mind. And then on top of that, like the Vietnamese community was given this weird sort of history of a lot of these men were like 12 years old when they left Da Nang or Saigon, and they were children of previous government that were locked up, and they came living through hardship. So not only did they have like really smart genes, they also had this history of living on the streets, being really poor. Then they were given a chance to come to the new land and new opportunity to make a lot of money. So my question to them is like, okay, so you were given the genetics to excel at school. All of you here have done extremely well at school. And then after school, you guys went and worked at these big capital firms or investment firms or became doctors, whatever. And the fuel that gave you guys the opportunities was the impact that that war had on you. So it was like the perfect storm of these things that you were given, and now here we are at this table. And you look at the poor members of our American society, and you're like, I think that not only were they not given that kind of history, but they're given 400 years of a different type of history of being repressed and oppressed. And then you could say that because of whatever, they weren't blessed with the nature, the natural sort of talent that was given to you guys. So now we're looking at every single day of your lives, you guys are more productive, and every single days of the poor in America, they're less productive. And year after year after year, there's no way to reconcile the distance that has happened. So it's like on the playground when there's like 100 marbles and 10 kids are playing it, and the kids that can really shoot marbles, the two of them that can really shoot it get the 100 marbles. I mean, there's, and you play this game over and over and you let it play out on the playground over and over and over again. The top kid and the top two kids are always going to win the marbles from the other 10 kids, other nine kids. That's what we're dealing with. And I think it's a natural situation that's happening all over the world. And we don't have breaks to stop it. And I don't know if having government step in and say, hey, the best marble players, you can't play marbles.
You need to step aside.
You need to get out. Yeah. Or you could play all this fake game like it's fun. And you guys just have to redistribute the marbles after.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
You'll have a lot of people getting angry. That's probably why, like, a lot of our parents.
At the dinner table, they were all like, we're not giving our marbles. We worked too hard.
We worked hard for it.
Yeah. And then some of them were like, you know, what's really unfair is like, I almost died, you know, when I was a kid. My dad died, or, you know, I had a really effed up childhood. You can't take that away from me. Yeah. It's not fair that I went through that and I almost didn't make it out. And many of the kids that I grew up with didn't make it out and they're still there. And I just made the best, you know, life that I had. So I'm questioning how fair life is, you know, at the end of the day, ultimately, mm-hmm. how fair is this?
Yeah. And I think we can both agree there's different angles that you come at it. It's a very difficult problem, but the world isn't a fair space, right? Like, there's been hundreds of years of colonial British rule that set up the systems that we see today. And maybe, yeah, at 1960s, around that time, these countries have gotten independence, but it's like, oh, here's independence, work on it and we'll walk away. That's basically, in a nutshell, a lot of the things that happen. And at the individual levels that you're talking about, like, I celebrate the folks that are successful. And I think part of our role is to be curious of the fact that, yes, there was hardship, but one, should we kick the ladder behind us and not find opportunities for folks and share in our earnings? Because let's be curious of the fact that, do we need more? Like, do we need to be hoarding this much money? And what's the point of that? One, two, you know, I think even the folks that you're having dinner with and your Hennessy's of the SOP, I don't know if they see that our community, the Vietnamese community, is not a nebulous, like, we're all successful folks, right? There are people that are still in poverty. And I'm also curious of the fact that maybe those folks don't have the same background that even my parents did. Like, they were former government officials. My mother used to work for NGOs that were foreign NGOs. So I get it. I think there's an element that you said there's some history there, even though it was reset and we're refugees. I do think my parents pushed me and knew that education was really important and this is the path I needed to take, and encourage that. But not every family has that kind of dynamic. There's families that were, you know, started off impoverished in Vietnam and were forced to leave too. So I'm curious to all those factors, but I don't know what the right answer is. I'm curious, like, what you think is the right answer, because obviously telling the folks that are rich to step aside is not that. My feeling, because again, I'm in philanthropy, is like, let's encourage the folks that have share their knowledge and their wealth, because it's the right thing to do. And also, let's face it, it's a safe thing to do. In history, when do you have civil war and issues? It's when the income disparity gets greater and greater. This is when, like, the French starts overthrowing the history of their country, right? Like, let's be real here.
That's the point in every country when the poor starts to revolt. It's right now. It's actually right now. And you know, honestly, I think if former President Trump did get assassinated, I really think we would have been, our world here in the United States would have been, there would have been chaos. Because I think that the poor amongst that core group is feeling like, this was something that was, you know, like, in their mind, the conspiracy is like, what more do we, our leader has just been shot, and it's going to, like, tailspin into something like a revolt or a French Revolution. Yeah. I really believe that could have happened.
That's interesting. So it sounds like you kind of are a conspiracy theorist and running through these
No,
scenarios.
not at all. I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all. No, all, no, I'm just commenting. I'm just commenting on the fact that we are very close
Yeah.
to a sort of a revolution or a revolt. We could be very close when poor people see things in a conspiracy minded. So I'm not just to.
I'm teasing you. He is not a conspiracy theorist. Let's make that very clear.
I'm just commenting on how close poor people in America that support Trump could have taken it to the next level because of poverty and being pushed to certain sort of optics, right? But no, I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all.
I do appreciate that you're saying you don't think the government is the solution. I'm curious why you think that, especially because, that's a lot of my space is
No, I didn't.
advocating for institutions and
I didn't
governments
say
to
that.
help support poor people.
I don't think I said that government is not the answer. I don't think that it's the total answer. I think it's more private individuals who make a lot of money need to find that empathy and compassion. How do we seed the money makers and make them feel empathetic and compassionate? I think that's more of the new model. How do we get them to really feel like it's their obligation to pitch in and make a better society?
I mean, there's a lot of really great work that is happening with the Giving Pledge, where there are very clear leaders like Warren Buffett, Sarah Blakely, who founded Spanx. They've signed up to give up more than half of their wealth in their lifetimes, which I think is astonishing as you start looking at the stats of the highest net worth individuals and what resources they represent as a whole. I think that's a start, but further pushing, like, what are you doing besides just saying you're going to do it? Like, what can we do to encourage the right type of investments and be curious of the fact that, hey, where governments do fail, ask why? Well, maybe it's because their tax dollars aren't like they're not raising enough tax money to pay for the education. I think these are all a cycle of sorts that we have the ability, and these individuals also have the agency to support. So I think the flexibility and not just some pet project because this is the country I care about, or this is the issue I care about. Like, I love Mackenzie Scott's model. I love Melinda French Gates' model. They are cutting the checks. And guess what? They are women cutting the checks. There might be some data that let's make sure we spotlight. These women are changing the game
Yeah,
and
we'll
by
see.
example, doing some amazing work. So
We'll see a woman.
I think what you're talking about is exactly it. Yes,
We'll
government
see
is a
a woman
component.
change.
Not the only answer. What can we do to continue to push for more engagement and charitable giving, philanthropy, and support?
Maybe the
Again,
next.
recognizing it's not a fair system. It is possible that we benefit even as refugees benefited from certain systems.
Maybe the next step is just to have a woman president, and then we can revisit this conversation. Okay, I remember now what we would talked about at dinner. I remember now clearly what my response was to all of this. And I think, we had about, I think, four progressives at the table, liberal progressives, and we had four like staunchly really conservative guys. So the room was very balanced. And I brought up this at the very end. I said, I think it is not about anything other than we have special interest money in politics today, all over the world. And I think that somehow bled into the way we do business all over the world, not just America, but Europe, Vietnam. Everybody has money in the political system. And I think that that has truly been corrosive and has created the disparity between rich and poor. And I think that is the real problem. And
And the reaction, were you invited back to dinner, first of all? Second of all, the reaction in
they
the
said that
room.
I'm a lifetime, because of that idea, I am a lifetime member. I mean, that is the problem. You go everywhere in the world. It's just money inside of politics that move the rich closer to being much more richer, and the poor has no voice. And if we could figure out a magical pill, a magic bullet to get rid of that problem, that is where we will see improvement in everybody's lives. I really think there's the money in politics is corrupted the Supreme Court. It's corrupted all the war that we go on. It's because there's so much money lobbying, whether you're in Vietnam or the United States. Yeah. It's happening in governments everywhere.
Yeah. I do find it interesting, as having been on the receiving end of that lobbying, I understand it makes the case. Sometimes these folks who are being advocates for U.S. jobs, that's often the collateral that is being used. It's not money. It's how many jobs did I bring to your state, right? That, at least that's in the U.S. framework.
Absolutely.
But I'm also very curious to the fact that, like, is it possible that there should be money backing the poor's advocacy? Should there be lots more money backing humane policies? Is it removing the money from the lobbying or competing with the lobbies with substantial amounts of money for, like, humane policies?
I see the angle you're getting. Yes, I understand. I think that
I just put that idea out there. Discuss, like, what do you think about
that? Yes, obviously I'm in full support of that. but how do you make the distinction of the poor? How do you make a distinction for fighting for the impoverished?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's civil society organizations, and it's a very disparate landscape that they're in different corners advocating for this community, this geography, this demographic, etc. And I think, you know, having been in the space of advocacy, lobbying, and government, there is impact when things are mobilized. There is impact when you say, actually, in this block of influence and jobs that you can create to grow the pie, not jobs to preserve only, these are the things that we should be moving forward. The tools of the trade are quite interesting, right? It's the advocates, it's the think tanks that craft the policies, it's the funding of said think tanks and the advocates, and it's the funding of those institutions that help support a coalition. And if you were to use some of the, you know, student protests as one angle in the U.S., you've seen for various issues, not just the current ones, but, like, there's that too. But what if that has funding behind it, the same way that certain demographic lobbyists supporting one community in the U.S., which I will not name on this podcast, has been strong and a block voting and, you know, as a coalition. I wonder if that's a possibility to not just saying, hey, no funding, because I think it's like water, right? You can write the laws, but there are always ways to work around it. You know, like I'm always fascinated by all those firms on K Street figuring out ways to get around lobbying rules.
Okay, so how do you motivate lobbyists to move in the direction of standing up for the poor?
Yeah, right. Funding.
How do you get the funding? What motivates and inspires that funding to move towards the poor?
Yeah, you know, I think this is, again, part of the whole institution of philanthropy. It's like, what is your big bet and what is your big strategy? And figuring that out and unlocking the funding for that issue is always that, the mindset, like, how does that work? And the inner mechanisms there, but not all philanthropy is coordinated. Not all individuals, high net worth, the folks that you're drinking Hennessy with, have family offices. And, you know, it is an individual cutting checks and things like that. So yeah. Is there a model out there that could be more collaborative, and those people are okay with reducing their power and simply writing the checks the way that some philanthropies are for this issue? As long as it's for this issue to move that along, we want to see the result of, but I don't need to control the thing. I think that's happening. It's the new model, again, that's being trailblazed by Mackenzie Scott and Melinda French. So it's quite exciting to see, again, women trailblazers doing the things. It comes full circle.
I do want to ask about, I want to drift into this idea of KPIs. Are there indexes on progress, and can we or should we be tracking when we give money out to the captains of the stewards of poverty or getting poverty corrected, is there KPIs? Are there things that we can say, here's the metric? And if there is, and if there's a system of doing it, how often is it reached? How often are these targets fulfilled?
Yeah, it depends on the issue. If you talk about health, there's plenty of institutions that measure health by, you know, lives saved, reduction in child mortality rates, et cetera. Education, same thing. In my line of work with financial inclusion, the World Bank actually has an index called the FinDex. And easy to remember, Financial Inclusion Index, FinDex. That comes out every 3 years and it measures whether or not the work we do has made a dent to put accounts and money in the hands of people who had not been banked before. And so there is, and our institution is very data centric. Not every philanthropic institution or, you know, high net worth giver has the same sort of data driven mindset, but we often put out there and support those indices to ensure accountability. So there is that in our space. And it's wonderful to see that there is the measurement. But back to my earlier point, like everybody's trying their best to figure out the solution for that. Some people are thinking microfinance and microcredit. That's been like something that started since the 70s. And then, you know, here, my world is thinking about digital financial services. How does mobile money help a rural woman in Vietnam have a bank account, be able to be onboarded, save money instead of putting that money in a tin can and have the vulnerabilities of that, right? So we think about, well, what are those stepping stones in the progress so that the larger index and we see the progress over time. And we have seen progress over time. I think another element of the poverty disparity, we feel it because in the US we have high inflation. Folks are, you know, you see folks on the street, but the unemployment rate has never been lowest in the past multiple years. So it's like the data says this, but you may feel something different. But the income disparity, certainly that is something that is a different dynamic. And it's not necessarily speaking of poverty, but it's talking about, well, mobility, economic mobility in the middle class getting like eroded. So that's a different dynamic. But when it comes to like abject poverty and definitions of poverty that the World Bank, the UN share, China actually has eliminated poverty in the past like 4 years. Like there was an announcement that literally says there's no more poverty in China, but the income disparity is still pretty high. So the data is really showing improvements, but there's still a lot more to go when it comes to what's the dignified job, what's the what is the quality of life, what is the you know, the wealth and poverty income gap that we're seeing.
Can we return to this China declaring that they got rid of poverty? Like, what does that exactly mean?
Is the abject poverty is completely non-existent according to China. I'm not an expert on this, okay, but I do know this was a huge milestone. And I believe that data because they actually have very good systems in place. I'm not saying China is the perfect country, but the central government has made a lot of very amazing measures for financial inclusion, giving access for farmers and the rural poor to credit and banks. And they have the resources in the middle of nowhere to build the brick and mortar agriculture bank and telling the bank you need to support this community and provide the loans and the access and the onboarding. So it's been many decades of a policy that they've employed. And so, yes, it is possible. I think some people are wary about that.
It's like, yeah, I was just going to get into that. I'm like, the next 5 minutes of you and I dialoguing and having conversation could sound like a total farcical, like funny thing.
Yeah, right.
But I do want to be very serious about the next 5 minutes of our conversation about abject poverty being gone in China. Mm-hmm. So let me get this straight. Do you believe it? And if you say, yes, I do believe it, what exactly are we talking about? And How in the world does the United States not tackle that problem when its friend China has done it already? I mean, what is the, how is this real? This is like, I've been living on this earth for all these years, and a big country like 1.3 billion people, you're trying to tell me a country like with 1.3 billion people, there's no abject poverty. And then exactly what does that mean?
Yeah, it's extreme poverty, right? So we're talking about less than $2.50 a day, people. And they had very targeted programs to those individuals, very targeted, like, oh, where are they? How do we get them jobs? What are the programs? What are the things that limit their employability? That kind of thing. It's a different economy. It's a different government model. There's a lot more, as you know, direct policy to action, a little less debate. And once they say that that is the target, when they started the target in 2013, by 2020, this is what's going to happen. There are a lot of people along that entire chain from Beijing all the way to rural Yunnan who's accountable for that. And so I, you know, we, in my work, we look at what were those measures? Why did it work? How could we replicate the best practices? Again, in service of the poor. So yeah, we can go into a rabbit hole. I believe it is true, because I've seen these policies being activated, and all of the elements of the government are all accountable. The central bank, the State Department, which is a different State Department, they manage literally the country, the Politburo, the political folks, like all of them. You're making me sound like I'm advocating China, but it's really like the targeted policies.
That's, so that's why it's so farcical right now. I'm like, oh, here we are.
I know.
Here we
go. You know, actually, having lived there, I will speak truth to this, because this is an experience. At the end of the day, we are individuals that happen to live in arbitrary places in the world, where people have drawn these arbitrary borders and then they name the thing, right? If you tell me I'm advocating for China, I'm like, that's kind of funny, because I'm actually advocating for the policy that this particular manager of this body working for. The US has excellent policies, but also we have terrible policies. I think we've lost $40 billion in the PPP program because the system did not know where the money should go and send electronic money to individuals. Like, it's okay, but there are things that worked well, like free education for folks, and it's inspired a lot of countries out there. So it's pretty tricky. Like, when you hear folks say nice things about China, I find it hard. People get really upset. It's okay to point out good things that China does. It's all right.
I was totally going to make a bad joke, and then you had to go explain everything so well. I was going to be like, oh, so it's not that bad if China took over the world. You know?
Oh, no, don't say that. This is where I will be voted off the Vietnamese diaspora tribe.
I know somebody's going to take a sound clip of that, and I'm going to. Like, I was on the podcast, this other Vietnamese podcast, about a month and a half ago, and they took literally the sound clip that I said, "A Vietnam Sung Lam," and they just took that out of context. So somebody's going to take this out of context.
There are good things that are, you know, I also lived in Vietnam for a hot second during college, and it's a country within the borders that have people who share our similar DNA. And we have a lot more in common. And I think the more that we can realize that, again, back to my heart of hearts and my values, is like, we can't be defined by the sound bites that we say. We are deeper humans than that. And we cannot point fingers and not recognize other people's humanity without putting out there our humanity and thinking it's a one-way thing. Like, it's not possible. So whoever just grabbed that soundbite and faulted you and say, why won't you move back to Vietnam? I think they miss that finer detail of, like, we are loving people that want to see the humanity in many, and the stories and the good of all places and things. And yeah, we cannot be handicapped by and define ourselves only by the tragedies in which our lives and our parents' lives have been affected by we are more complex and deeper humans than just that. So I'm giving you credit for being controversial and saying the things. Do you find it hard for you to kind of put out there like balanced experiences and stories of the Vietnamese diaspora, whether they're in Vietnam or not even diaspora, Vietnamese?
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, I find myself having to self-censor a lot, you know, because I don't want to offend the left. I don't want to offend the right. I don't want to offend Vietnam. You know, I don't want to offend. I don't want to turn people off to listening to... I believe in slowly opening the door to more openness. And I think that if you go and take a hard right, hard left, hard, you know, whatever, you're going to turn off a lot of people quickly. So I think that's the problem that I have. I really...
It is a problem. You keep trying to grow your tent. What's wrong with you?
You kind of have to have people trust that you are listening with, because I'll have a veteran at Fox News Corporation on. I'll have these veterans of wars come on the podcast. I used to be a U.S. Marine. I used to vote Republican, but today I'm somewhere in the middle of all of it. You know, there's things that I love about the Republican Party. That's going to be a sound clip. Somebody's going to clip.
Kenneth Wynn, lover of the Republican Party.
There's some things that I absolutely adore about the Democrats. You know, there's these things about America that I worship at the altar of. And there's things that I can't say that the U.S. does better than Vietnam in certain aspects. You know, there's certain things that each side has. And I'm here to talk about and discuss the nuances of all the things in between.
I love that you're talking about the nuances. Again, we're not binary people that are defined by two different parties. We're not defined by government systems. I love that you're curious and ask those questions. Like, what defines you, right? Like, tell me more. Use other words besides these shorthands. Like, tell me why you gravitated towards that. Oh, okay. You believe in you know, self-motivation, not getting a handout, and efficient governments. Okay, great. Like, let's open the aperture by talking about those things. I don't want to put it under a banner of a thing. That's a shorthand that I think doesn't do you credit and doesn't do your deep complexities of why you came to those things and your values credit. So I really love, and I think we see each other as similar advocates that way. Like, how do we open our aperture and grow our tent, right? And we have a big tent. We could label it the Vietnamese diaspora, but even within that, we can be curious to the things that we have in common, and we can be adults and debate and talk about the great things about Vietnam that are going well, and be critical as well. It's possible.
The irony of taking a very small position to learn about the Vietnamese culture. The irony is that in the exercise of exploration of this small group of people, you realize the parallels of humanity in the Italian culture, the Salvadorian culture, all over the world. We're the same. We have different stories, but the irony is we're all living the same way. We have the same problems politically. We have the same problems in our families. And so that's sort of like my way of approaching universal storytelling by these individual vignettes of stories in the Vietnamese diaspora and in Vietnam.
Yeah. And I love that that's your motivation, that you're curious and want to understand, and that drives you. And I've asked you this before, what is the root of you wanting to be so curious? Like, to what ends are you doing this? And I heard you say it's my own thing, like almost this is my voyeur thing, but I think there's more to it. And I think you're sharing a little bit about that. Like, you believe that it's possible we have a lot more in common And there's enough space for us to have these complex conversations and still space for us to share our individual stories and see our common humanity.
Well, I think if you're asking me the question of sort of how did I get to get this curious, maybe, I'm not sure if that's exactly.
Yeah, I'd love to learn more about
okay.
that.
I think because I see how closed off my mom and dad were when it came to religion. And I've seen my uncles when it comes to politics. And I've seen the Vietnamese closed off in their own world with their own culture. And then you realize that this is not just happening in the Vietnamese world. But the more that we could talk about this closed identity where we're like, oh, this is what makes us who we are. In exploring that, it opens up everybody's minds who are listening. And it says to everybody, hey, they might be afraid of something because this trauma happened, or they might be really excited about something happening because this wonderful thing happened in their past. This happens because whatever happened. And you really realize that we're all just human beings with things happening. And we just have this collective experience called the Vietnamese. And because we can sit here and explore all these different stories within the Vietnamese space, we can open up our hearts and minds to other cultures like China, like Taiwan, to neighboring countries in Cambodia and Laos.
Yeah.
We could just be open up to our neighbors to the north. If we're living in Saigon, our neighbors to the left, to the right. And only through storytelling, I think, do we kind of like open up our minds and our hearts.
Yeah. Do you have a, have you been successful reaching to your parents with these stories and why you do what you do? I'm very curious how, because you say that's the root of some of this curiosity, because you've observed like how close-minded some of your family members could be. Like,
yeah,
have you been successful in chipping away at those walls?
Yeah, the boastful answer to that, like the very show-off answer to that is yes, I have been very successful with my mom. My father passed away about 11, 12 years ago, but so I never really got a chance to exercise this stuff. But my mother used to be against homosexuality. My mother used to be a diehard advocate for pro-life, anti-abortion. She used to be a lot of these things that her Catholic upbringing was about, and gay marriage was out of the question. And a lot of these mental health issues were something that she said, what's the big deal? This is just life, deal with it. So now I think there's very open to the nuances of the Catholic Church and homosexuality. You know, what does it mean to go to hell? What does it really mean to go to heaven? Like, these things are have melted away in her staunch, very Catholic mind. So I think I've done a great job with my mom, and the thing that I hope to do with the rest of the world is not push the Vietnamese community like I push my mother, but do it through stories of other people and opening minds and hearts of other people in the Vietnamese world to make our community a better place.
I think you might be in a very unique, rare error of being able to advocate to parents to change hearts and minds, your mom to change hearts and minds. In fact, I think there are many listeners that would love to hear more about how you were able to do that, and but with a how-to. And if you do have that memoir, I think you should add in there the how-to. Of how you did that, because I mean, I almost, in a boastful moment, I would almost say that I'm probably one of the world's experts in advocacy, and the hardest advocacy that I do is actually reaching my parents to change hearts and minds there. So if you were able to crack the code, I think you have the $1 million answer.
Okay, but let me ask you a question now, because I think that living with in close proximity of your mom and dad, like living with them or living very close to them, has a big effect. So that let's really start there. If you're not living with them or living very close to them, that's like saying I'm going to train my daughter to play piano, but I live, you know, I live across the country, and I'm going to train my 7-year-old daughter that I divorced from her mother, and I'm going to teach her how to play piano from, you know, East Coast to West Coast. I think it's very difficult to instill a certain way And here's the example. Whenever there is an article that comes out from the Vatican that says Pope Francis has apologized to this group of homosexuals for this reason, I literally bring the article over to my mother and go, hey, mom, I just want you to hear me explain this to you from our lovely Pope Francis. And then I'll break it down. And that's how I have been able to do it because of, my mother lives with me. And so we're able to really have this dialogue. And so that's a real big advantage that I have. You know, boasting aside, I mean, the advantage is because I live, you know, we live together, so we can do that.
Proximity. Yes. But you know what I just heard you say, like you're finding champions, that they look up to.
Correct.
Right. And you're bringing it to her in a way that opens a conversation, not like, this is what you need to do. But it's approach of, can we explore this together? Because help me understand something like that. I think there's an element of that. I get it. It's very retail. I love that. You're deeply immersed. I think we've all struggled, right? Being in different... two different cultures, if it's not the issues that you raised with your mom's views, I think a lot of your listeners may have any number of other things that they do have a hard time. And let's face it, language barrier is often a challenge there.
Yeah, that's a
and
big
And so deal. I like your ideas of like the champions and who do they listen to and what are those elements that you can bring into the conversation. Really smart.
So proximity, language is another thing. I speak fluent Vietnamese as a result of living, you know, together with my mother. We speak every day. We were in business together for many, many years. I was her right-hand man. She was my right-hand person, you know, in business. Mm-hmm. So very deep sense of bonding, loyalty, trust, the whole thing. But she came from a different era of the Vietnamese church. So I'm not going to name names on this podcast, but I'm very close to certain priests, Catholic priest friends of hers that I believe are living a different kind of embodiment that she thinks that they're living, right? So I will coordinate dinners or I'll coordinate conversations with these priests and my mom, and I'll just bring up topics, and these priests will be further left than I am. They'll just totally rag on Trump because they're not on the pulpit. They could do it behind closed doors.
A dinner.
So
this little person there and have them talk on our behalf.
So years of this now, my mother is a Democrat. She really fights and rebels against her church friends who are pro-Trump people. And I now have to pull her back. She's gone too far to the left. And I said, Mom.
She's gone too far.
gone too far. We got to pull it back here a little bit with some more nuance thinking and discussion. We can't go too far in one extreme because the polarization of these conversations doesn't make any sense either. So we got to figure how to attack these questions in an intelligent way.
And any advice for your listeners and how you are dealing with the dissonance that you started with? And what your mom had and dad maybe at the time, you know, had shared with you. Like, how do you cope with that?
You have to remember that you have very little time left on earth. You have to go hard at it. That is my, you know, like I'm dealing with this.
Kenneth Wynn, starting arguments in families across the world.
You got to come at them with unconditional welcome.
Welcome and love.
Yes. Welcome and love, empathy, and you don't go with the idea of changing hearts. You go with the idea of just listening. And listening makes the other party feel
seen,
safe.
Yeah.
They feel heard. And once you get that, then you could like creep in and go, the questions. You pose questions. You don't give them your viewpoint. You give them questions. So, Mom, what do you think about like gay people all going to hell? Like that doesn't make sense. Can you?
And then explain to me how that works.
Yeah, explain. Yeah. So I think years of just sort of like listening and then just coming and not giving my mom statements, but giving her questions. And that's easier said than done, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think many times we get emotional and we want to get get them to see it right away. But I think we take time, and we got to realize that their time on earth is limited. And why do we need to change their hearts and mind?
Mm.
What's the rush? What's the big deal?
I think you're sitting in a position, I'm just observing this, like you're in the strongest negotiating position, right? You're like, if I change your heart mind, I can. If I don't, that's cool. We still love each other. The negotiating thing you have on the table is that you don't have such a stake in the game to change, right? And I think some of us come at it like, oh my God, why is my dad racist or sexist? And how do I change that tomorrow? Whereas, oh man, he's living his truth. Maybe I'll put here and there some ideas because that's my value. And I'll make my position known some of the broadcasting that you're telling us to avoid, but like ask the question while you broadcast. Hey, what do you think about that? That's really smart. And it certainly keeps us sane in our world.
There's an uncle that I have, a few uncles that are very pro-Trump. And I think in the early days, I watched my brother come back from Vietnam and just go to town on them. And it would feel like he was much more educated. My brother is educated. He reads up on all the politics. And so he called me about 3 years ago, my brother, and he said, hey, man, I figured it out. I figured out why those people, our uncles and cousins, have turned off, have not responded to us. He figured it out. He goes, it's just one word, Ken, and you got to remember this to the day you die. He's like, it's the letter R. Just remember the letter R. It's resentment. It's resentment that you might have more data. You might be more smart. You might be more educated. Mm-hmm. They're resentful. So they have to come harder. So then when I heard that, I was like, that makes perfect sense. So from now on, my primary job is to do the opposite of making people feel resented or resentment towards me. Because if I'm making them feel resentment, their ears are shut down.
Yeah.
And we have no
chance. They're coming up with their boots up. Yeah, right. Yeah.
They're defensive and they're resentful. And then they walk away going, F him. He thinks he's smart and he thinks he's educated. And the list goes on. And we've segmented the family now. So we have cousins and uncles that don't talk to me.
So you're worried about your dark arts.
So I've now made a huge commitment to re-engaging with that side of the family and remembering the word resentment and never to let them feel that again. And I've been slowly successful at that.
And maybe the opposite of resentment is dignity. How do we have like a dignified conversation about this? Yeah.
The only way to do it is to listen. That is really the only way. Ask questions and listen.
And here we are asking the questions. Here you are asking the questions.
I do not want to end this podcast without talking about your work at the Gates Foundation. Can we talk about it?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to.
Okay. This is going to be a very amateur style question, but I hope that from this answer that we can build a bigger picture of your work and your life going forward. What is your day or what does your week look like in terms of action items?
A lot of meetings. No, so the Gates Foundation is a family foundation that is off of giving funding away. It's a giving organization with an endowment from donations from Warren Buffett and the Gates family. We have an institution that covers over 30 areas for poverty alleviation. A lot of it started with health related areas, asking the questions like, should this person die of cholera just because they were born and the birth lottery took them to this corner of the world where they didn't have the right sanitation and health things. So the 30 other strategies include financial inclusion. So my day, besides thinking about like what are the investments I can make in the organizations that could help address financial inclusion issues. It's also connecting the dots with data that we've researched ourselves. So we're also a research institution, are also funding researchers, and connecting those that data to folks who can do something with that data in a very basic way. So I could have a call with other donors to encourage them to give more money because we've seen an opportunity to do better here if there's more resources, or if it's a call to an organization that is in this country that is doing work around unbanked populations and reaching them in different models. What can we do to maybe put in some human-centered design research that we know of? So I'm often a connector. So I spend my day thinking about, like, what are those roadblocks that get in the way of financial inclusion? Where are the friends that we can bring into this tent to help support it? And where is the best impact, and where is the most acute need at the time? So it's multifaceted. I think this is why it's like, what do you guys do at the Gates Foundation besides run around with 15-hour plus days? That is it, because it is a privileged position of a resource organization, but we are not wasting that funding. It is really to be a thoughtful funder that is supporting data and data-backed interventions to help poverty alleviation. And we've been doing this for, I think this is our 25th year. I've joined the foundation about 5 years ago, working in financial inclusion. And I'm expanding that work into digital public infrastructure, which is another thing about partnering with governments to provide better services to its people.
Have you ever heard of, in the last 25 years, where money was allocated to a bad actor?
Bad actor? You mean like to governments or institutions, yeah, or parties?
Who watered the money, who hasn't really felt, you know, they didn't follow through with the plan.
Yeah.
I wonder about that. Like all.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I wouldn't label them as bad actors. Oh, so okay. I think, how about this? I often equate our giving and our we call them investments. We're like seed investors in the development space. We'll try. We will seed a good idea. And if it fails, then that's the risk capital. And in the other spaces, there are countries with taxpayer dollars providing development aid. And you know a history of that and the funding and the flows and all kinds of stories that happen to that. We know that we're but one tiny drop in the bucket of this larger, development sector. And so it's not bad actors. It's more like an idea that was good at the time that didn't work out. Mm. So it's often, how do we fail fast, like an entrepreneur would? And when something does work, make sure it sticks and call up your friends to do series A, B, and C so that they're not wasting their taxpayer dollars. That's kind of how I think about our giving, because we have, in our institution, I quoted a colleague. I mean, this is just one, there's about 2,000 of us in the world, and they're smart people that want to do well and are very thoughtful about who we recommend investments to and what institutions. And then there's a whole due diligence that we have. So it's not like we're cutting checks to a person, it's to an organization with the end goal of the impact. And so it's the trappings and the measures that we take are pretty rigorous, but flexible relative to countries and other donors in the space.
You know, your answer reminds me of what I have to remind myself all the time, which is when I'm such a generalist with the world, right? I, you know, maybe I know a little bit about the entertainment industry. That's probably where I can kind of hang my hat a little bit. But even then, there's levels to the understanding of the business, right? You probably have this massive understanding of giving money to organizations to fulfill philanthropic needs. What are the things that you, before you got in, had like this idea of what philanthropy was? And then finally, when you got in, you're like, wait a minute, this is not right. and this is really the better, the more clear picture. Like that word that I just said, bad actors, that just shows you how little I know about the actual intentions of where the money is being allocated. And right, it's just like those small mechanical kind of details are just so fascinating. And what is it that you learned after doing this for 5 years now?
It's an easy answer. I didn't know anything about development before coming in, so I would probably be asking your question too. So you're among friends here. I just want to put that on the table. Like, you know, what motivated me to get this job was I basically, if you think about it thematically, my job is in sales. I was selling the US, right? In diplomacy, selling aircraft, selling strategies. And then here I'm an advocate trying to sell poverty alleviation ideas. So what I do know is I really care about women's financial inclusion and making sure that there's representation of smart money that are owned by women and managed. So I'm like, literally went on LinkedIn. I'm like, my job's in financial inclusion. So this is how I got my job. And so my preconceived notions are thus the same as yours, like as a generalist. Oh, cool. Then this Gates Foundation, they care about poverty alleviation. Cool. I have no idea who they're giving their money to. And I'm pretty sure most of the people on the street, like if you ask them, they're like, first thing they're like, do you have any money for me? I get that a lot. And the second thing is they don't know who we're cutting those checks to. And like now, as I realize this, it isn't just me as an individual writing checks to a person. It is literally like we have a set strategy and a plan that's data informed. What are the parties that are the smartest to activate this strategy out there in the spaces that we care about? And then we are delivering funds to nonprofit organizations or equivalencies in the world to do this work. So a lot of it is like UN technical assistance facilities, like people who are UN employees whose focus is on policy. And they are working with governments to ensure that the policies are inclusive or is impactful for women's financial inclusion. So what are the data protection policies that they could help the government develop? So that's kind of where the money goes. I had no idea when I joined the foundation that that was the case, but that's the shorthand. Usually we are either finding nonprofits or equivalencies in the world that are doing this work. And if there isn't one, we would help build one. It may not be a Gates Foundation organization, but there are lots of smart people who want to start up an organization focused on that. So sometimes we work with them to build those institutions to help support that need.
Can you walk me through just the basics of like A to Z, like how you find an appropriate organization that needs money, all the way to putting the money in the bank, all the way to getting a report back to see if they actually accomplished the mission?
Yeah, and there's a few things that start that process in the beginning, right? Is what is the issue that we're trying to solve for? And often my job, again, I work in my portfolio, is financial inclusion, finding donors in this space. And donors being like France, Germany, UK, Switzerland, Luxembourg. How do I convince folks who are managing the development strategy there to care about financial inclusion and these things that we think will help alleviate poverty across multiple measures of success. And so often I ask the question, like, who are those folks talking to? Who are like your mom? Like who's their pope, right? And who are the trusted institutions that they are working with? So I'm not coming up with these organizations from thin air. So like, for example, there's an organization called the OECD. It's a member-based organization that countries partner up with. So I would call up the OECD and was like, hey, you know, this is an issue that's really important. I think your countries should know about it. Are you interested in exploring what we can do together to raise those issues in your membership and partner on doing more research on what are other ways that this issue can be furthered? That's usually how that comes together. It's through the curiosity of where can the impact be made and who are the parties that could do it. Usually it's an existing organization and we ask them to stretch a bit, or they're already doing it and we fund them to do more
Do you guys actually actively reach out to these organizations? Don't come to you?
Normally, I think I reach out to them because I spend my day like researching is like, who are those institutions? Or it's a referral, right? So if USAID is working with organization and they've had a history and they know that they're smart and they have the right technical expertise in there, we have conversations like that all the time. But it's usually not an organization calling us. And if they are calling us, we still go through that same scrutiny, right? Like, what's your credibility in this space? What's your history of working there? What's your level of access? Because then my work is in advocacy. Are you the Pope of this issue, basically? Are you the Pope of this issue, bringing back to your mom and obviously for this topic and this area? Like, you laugh, but this is a very similar thing. You're at the micro level thinking about that. I'm at this, you know, institution level asking those questions. And usually, you know, they're nonprofit organizations. If they're not, then we have other ways, like, you know, we've funded and seeded startups, say in Bangladesh, to help with mobile money. And our role in that board is to say, what are you doing in your business strategy that is helping service women in remote areas that are unbanked? So there's different ways for us to do this, but for my particular area, most of the time, it's asking those three things. Do you have the technical expertise? Do you have the access? And do you have the credibility to continue doing this work? Yeah, so that's the start of it. We would then craft like a statement of work. That statement of work has, usually it's about a 3-year program, and you know, number of people that are involved, resources that are needed, convenings that we have to pay for, that's in a budget. They propose a budget to me, and then I then go to an investment committee, and you know, they all scrutinize our legal team. There's different layers to ensure it's not tau cutting a check to somebody. And then at the end of the day, that's where there's a partnership agreement that starts and we have an investment made. And then those institutions have to report back what is their impact based on what they committed to in the beginning of that process. And it kind of starts over. And when it starts over, we ask for existing partners, what could you do differently to make it even better? So we're kind of known in the development space for having the flexible funding, but having immense amount of scrutiny of that funding. Because at the end of the day, if you can't present to our leadership the impact, somebody's going to ask, what did you do with this money? And you cannot answer and show the impact. We are very hard on ourselves. So at the beginning processes, we ensure that it's making the impact in all the trappings. Does that make sense? That
makes a lot of sense. But as you're answering it, I always go back to, how does this apply to the motherland, right? And I think that you and I have had this conversation about, you're not really in that world, you're not in that space. But I have, you know, a lot of questions that have been prepared about the development cycle of developing countries. Mm-hmm. Why are countries called, you know, first world countries versus developing third world countries?
Yeah.
All of these designations, for me, always goes back to the motherland and how it applies back to our future as the Vietnamese global community. Mm-hmm. And I know you've said that you don't really live in that space, but will there be a time or day that you, or even now, that you think Việt Nam kêu bằng hướng về, hướng về quê nhà.
Do you think hướng về quê hương?
Hướng về quê hương. Will you ever, you know, do you ever consider using the knowledge that you've accumulated to, I hate using the word help Vietnam, because we're not helping anything.
Vietnam's doing great.
They're doing great.
Like, I don't know if we need to be helping Vietnam.
That's a dumb thing to say.
There's another quotable, like, you can have Vietnam's doing great, and then...
Yeah, we're, so many of us that I meet always says, you know, I want to go back to Vietnam to help them. I'm like, no. That you can't go to Vietnam to help anything. You go to Vietnam to help yourself, you know, basically.
Yeah, that's honest.
Yeah.
That's honest.
It's just being honest. Do you ever think of bringing this knowledge to Vietnam to develop further where Vietnam has already gone?
Yeah, in my line of work, actually, one of the building blocks to financial inclusion is this thing called payments, like interoperable inclusive payments. It sounds very techie, sorry. But at the end of the day, if a country has that, you can have a rickshaw driver charge you a dollar. And that dollar could be transacted through a mobile money transaction. The rickshaw driver gets paid a dollar. You pay them a dollar. And there is no middle person to take any of that money away. And that's kind of mind-blowing to some people, because especially in the US, that does not happen. Like if you go to my donut shop down the street, there's a minimum of $5 that you have to pay or purchase in order to pay transactions digitally with your card or with your Apple Wallet. They do that because there are certain service providers, I'm not going to name, that takes a cut of that. And when you're a donut shop that's making like less than $5 a transaction, every penny is meaningful, right? And so when we have the rails of this payment system, I can identify I need to pay Kenneth. The system knows that Kenneth has, the system knows that Tao has enough money and knows that Kenneth has the transaction and verifies that that's the transaction I want to send to Kenneth, and that's it. And so we have this system that we hope to see in many countries, and we also hope to see it in the region. So for Vietnam, where this is applicable, is we hope there's an interoperable payment system in Vietnam and many Southeast Asian countries. And we hope that those countries are connected together, because in countries like the Philippines, Vietnam, there are many migrant workers that are working in other countries. How are they sending money home? Like, right. That's a good question for somebody who works in that. Sometimes it's actual people that are moving the money around. Sometimes it's Western Union or another service provider, and they take a lot of money from that transaction, the same way that I brought up the idea of that rickshaw driver. So in that transaction of the rickshaw driver, Western Union could take up to 75 cents from that dollar, which is crazy if you really think about it. And that's meaningful, clearly. Yeah. So in Vietnam, where it applies in my work, we're hoping to build with partnerships with Singapore, Thailand, and the ASEAN countries, an interoperable instant payment system where we can create with countries those rails. So if Vietnam ends up choosing to work with us, it is the country saying, hey, we believe we need this interoperable payment system. You are supporting this open source software because you need the hardware and the software to make those transactions work. We support this software called Mojaloop. So if they choose that, we end up working quite a bit with the country. So I'm going to be working a lot with the Philippines. We work a lot with Singapore because they're advocating for this regionally, not just in the country with the rickshaw driver in Vietnam, but how about I want to send money for Thailand to Vietnam? Like, how do I do that in a way that, you know, the transaction costs are minimum and I could do this with like certainty and security? So that's kind of where the work that we can do would make a huge difference.
How many projects like that are you managing?
I don't manage it alone. There's a team of 30 of us that have geographic orientation and technical orientation, but we cover a lot of ground, and maybe this explains my 15 plus hour work days. But thank you for asking. I appreciate it.
We are managing a lot of projects. You are not joking about a 15 hour workday?
I'm not. We have 9 focused markets for financial inclusion. And then the payments piece is really one component of other digital public infrastructure that we see governments could take on so that they could be more effective in servicing their country and building entrepreneurship and digital markets. So they could be anywhere, but beyond the 9 focus countries or South Sahara, Africa, or Southeast Asia. So it's a lot. My day starts sometimes at 6 and doesn't end last night until like 6 p.m. So that was just calls. So Yeah.
Well, I want to apologize for taking 2 hours of your 15-hour day.
No.
I feel
This is a
you're.
nice break from my day of meetings. This is a joy to talk to you about my
Thank you.
work and my history and asking you. Actually, the advice you gave me may sharpen my advocacy game even more and help some families with their
Are you
conversation.
having issues with your family?
Me?
Yeah.
And why? Never. My dad is a very proud man, and I really appreciate you talking about the R word, right? And we've talked about this. Like, we have Confucian values where women's voices are not as, the same level as a man's voice. And age is a huge thing, and structures of hierarchy. My father still hangs on to that quite a bit. So it's really hard to have these conversations without immediately. The reaction is the R, right?
You know, the really messed up thing is, it's really messed up, is that for him to you, he might want to see things differently and feel a different way and be more open. But for some, can, and I've had this conversation with so many guys of that generation where they're like, oh, it's my daughter. I don't know why. I just can't open up and be more close to
Vulnerable, yeah.
vulnerable, be more honest. They
What's the
just
word for vulnerability in Vietnamese? I'm not
don't.
even sure I know the word for that.
You know, there might not be a word for it. There might not be a word for it. You know, I mean, language is always developing. And if you think about the evolution of meanings of words in Vietnamese, they're monosyllabic. And then you have to put two syllables together, sometimes three, to make a word. And I think when you think of like the word computer, it probably came about maybe in the 70s. So before 1970, I'm just making this up, right? Before 1970, you didn't have a word for computers in Vietnam. And
Yeah.
so before 2024, July 31st, there was no word for vulnerability. So you and I are going to have to pull this out of the ether and create a word for vulnerability using the monosyllabic features of our language. So if you
Didn't yay be tổn thương is what
didn't.
Google Translate says. You're
Didn't
right. It's like, let's give the vulnerability like five different words.
and you know that's five different attributes, but if you think about it, it's not even accurate. Didn't what didn't you
Didn't yay be
yeah babe, don't
on
do. That's like the characteristics of being easily wounded. That's what Google's saying it is.
Sư nhược kiếm, which I don't know that's a noun. That's
Yeah.
beyond my Vietnamese. You tested the limits right there.
So, you know, I think that having vocabulary to deal with this stuff is like, if you don't have the vocabulary, then the reality is not really there.
Yeah.
Right? Because words are everything. Words is meaning. Meaning is what you can see, what you can feel, what you can experience. And if you cannot experience the description of the word vulnerability, what are we working with?
What do we, it's hard. I have to tell you, like I don't think we joke about it on this podcast, but the value of you having be able to reach your mom and talk about things openly, things of controversy she's like diametrically opposed to, is huge. In fact, like in the history of ever, I've never heard of this before. It's possible. Go interview more people because this is clearly a service that you're doing to our community. Partially, we joke, but it is really one of healing and journeying together rather than us separately in our own trauma. I feel like this is that one of those pieces to unlock our healing. And we're all struggling with that in different ways. Like I joke about my dad, but yeah, it's tricky getting to him. He's like 85. Part of it is like, yeah, I think as an adult being self-aware, and I'm like, cool, I'm with you. Like, I'm not gonna change his mind. Let's just enjoy each other's
Yeah,
company
yeah.
instead.
Which is weird, right? Because I mean, I think about my children. I'm like, at any given point in the time that I'm 80 to 85, and the time that I die, like between 80 and the time that I die, I want my children to be able to come to me with any question about molecularly what I represent, atomically who I am. I will give you the blueprint. I will give you the factory instructions on who I was built to be in the world. And I want them to know me on every single level. And I wonder if they're going to take that opportunity to like bombard me with questions about, and then how am I going to react in my 80s or 70s to the questions that they have?
And hopefully they want to listen. That's my struggle right now with my 9-year-old. I love him to death. It's funny. I'm trying to get him to be like a feminist and he's like, not interested. And so I think maybe you keep the curiosity, but like hold back some of it.
So they can fight for it.
Might backfire. Kids are hard audiences in equal measure, I think.
They don't make them like they used to?
No, they don't. Clearly. Now we sound like old people. Kenneth, we're not doing ourselves a service here. Back in my day, if somebody asked me, I'd be so privileged to share.
Do you think you're going to be at the Gates Foundation for Life? Or are there any times where you're like, I wonder what it's like over there?
I don't know. I take one day at a time. I think I'm still at this like in awe. I feel like I'm in a privileged space. It's rare air of sorts. And also, I don't feel like I'm working. I joke the 15 hours. It's a joy. It's hard. But I really, I think I found just where an alignment of values, access, and the ability to activate impact in a way that I think is, I don't know if I'd be able to find that elsewhere.
Yeah,
but I don't know, Kenneth, would you like to give me a job? Maybe you and I could interview folks together. Look at how long our call is right now.
I know, it's one of the longest ones I've been on in a long time.
Man, cut me off. It sounds like once you get her started, you couldn't put her back in.
I tell you, it's all the ones that say, I have nothing to say. The ones that push down, that kick the can down the road, like let's just do it later. It's all of those people. Once you get the microphones turned on, they have the most to say.
You're so sweet. You made me feel very comfortable in a very clearly uncomfortable position that I normally am in. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And I'm very happy that you came on. And I also want to say something. I know you were just being tongue in cheek and being funny about offering you a job about whatever. I think that you would make a fantastic podcaster. I say that to a lot of my guests because a lot of the guests are wonderful, very inquisitive and full of information. But there is a funny thing that I've been wanting to talk about in this episode is there is a podcast called Acquired, and it's two guys that are like in the tech space. Have you heard of it?
No, I think you mentioned it before, but I'd love to learn more.
They did this one on Microsoft, and they went three generations before Bill Gates was born and talked about, you know, the founding of a bank by his grandfather, and then his father was a lawyer and his mother was like this big wig in society. And the beauty of like that podcast is like, so we get to hear you talk about your work in philanthropy through the Gates Foundation. And then we can see what the Bill Gates Foundation, who the people were that kind of like gave birth to this person who started this waterfall of philanthropic action that happened in the world. And today we could hear you talk about it. I would love to have a way to pair up with people like you that could co-host Acquired like podcast episodes. So I'm trying to do that in my everyday like
work. On the side.
On the side. Yeah, because I mean, think about like if we talked about issues on like the history of the word vulnerability that leads back to the lack of the word mental health just a few years ago in Vietnamese culture. There's a word for it now, but about 30 years ago, the word mental health was not probably as clear. The monosyllabic
word, like something's wrong with you if you're talking about mental health. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in our, especially in our community, that's really not something you talk about. I think this young generation is starting to open up to it, but you're right. There's no, you don't talk about, you hide those things. It's a family shame if it's something that is obviously a mental health issue. So yeah, it's the origins of things are really important.
Well, hopefully we can come on and talk about other things soon, because there's always stuff
that... I'm happy to be your sidekick. Just don't interview me again.
Thank you. Would you like to end this episode with any questions? Do you have any questions for me?
Well, I'd love to maybe end asking you a question.
Yeah.
And what would you like to see as your legacy?
I'm going to answer that without any self-centering. I'd actually like to see the ability to go back and forth. And I don't mean physically, but I mean that in community. The ability for everybody in the diaspora to go back and forth with people and infrastructures in Vietnam. I would love it if people in Vietnam felt comfortable coming out to the diaspora and doing projects and working more together to make the world of the Vietnamese global feel more cohesive. That would be my dream thing that I leave behind in the world, which is making a level playing field for anybody in the diaspora to go back and vice versa, that we can all have this fluid chance of opportunity to get to know each other and to maybe do business and create change.
That's amazing. Thank you. Thank you for the service that you do. It's a pleasure and an honor to be part of it.
Thank you for coming on. Thanks, Tao.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients, wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tung Fak.